I'd like to welcome you to the Austrian Circle. This is the program where we talk about the economics of freedom here on WHUS Stores 91.7 FM. So thank you so much for tuning into my show this morning. We are going to be talking about regulation on the show today. The common myth in society goes such as this. Well, companies are pretty bad and they do all sorts of terrible things, and without regulations, they would be polluting, they would be destroying the environment, they would be attacking their competitors, they would be making their customers pay egregious prices, and all sorts of incredibly terrible, poor quality objects would be going onto the market, and people would be very dissatisfied with those products. But wouldn't you know, thank goodness for all of the regulators who come in and bind these companies to the customers and make sure that everything's safe and that we have great products and that the customer is always served, and all of this stuff comes from government regulation and not from the inner workings of profit and loss and prices and competition within the marketplace. Now, of course, the reality is much different. Regulations actually hamper the market process and destroy competition by making it so that businesses who are able to adhere to those regulations, who can afford all of the costs involved in getting the regulators to be happy, meaning hiring lawyers to make sure that they know what the regulations are, putting all of the capital in place to satisfy the regulators' demands, all of those things can only be done by the companies who have the capital to be able to do such a thing. Newcomers to the market are hobbled immensely by these regulations because they have not accumulated the capital necessary to adhere to those regulations. And so as a result of these regulations, we see fewer and fewer companies that are able to compete. And oftentimes, we see the number of companies actually providing a product diminish immensely. So if we look back before the Great Depression, we saw that there were hundreds of thousands of banks all providing services. And then when the government came in with all the regulation that it did during the Great Depression, we end up with only a couple of banks. There's only a handful of them left. We saw the same thing with the meat industry. In the 40s and 50s, you'd had local butcheries, you had local farms that would create their own meat and things like that. And then, lo and behold, the regulations came in the 60s about the Meat Act and all of this stuff. And all of a sudden, all of those butcheries just disappeared. And now we only have a couple of producers who produce 80% of the meat in the entire country. All of this is due to regulation because, again, it creates monopolies in the market economy. We saw the same exact thing happen with doctors. In the early 1900s, there were hundreds of doctors all able to come to your house and provide you with these great services. And so the doctors went to the government and they got regulations passed so that they could benefit themselves. And then the number of doctors diminished immensely because they had licenses and they had regulations and all of these laws that reduced the overall supply of doctors available to meet the needs of consumers. And therefore, we have fewer and fewer people who are providing that product. And the story is the same anywhere you find government regulation at play. So the first article I'd like to read is by Howard Beecher Jr., and it is called "Government Regulators Are Unregulated. There is a Better Way: Regulation by the Market." In my article, there's no such thing as an unregulated market. I claim that regulation by market forces works better and gets better results for society than government regulation. But why does government regulation work so poorly? In government, the regulators themselves are in practice unregulated. Their accountability goes the wrong way, upwards to politicians rather than downward to the public. Consider the regulation of school quality. For decades, Americans have deplored the low quality of our government-regulated schools as compared to the higher quality of our market-regulated private sector schools. A Nation at Risk, National Commission on Excellence in Education, asserted in 1983 that, quote, if an unfriendly foreign power had attempted to impose on America the mediocre educational performance that exists today, we might well have viewed it as an act of war. Since then, not much has changed. There are some superb government schools, but there are also many in poor areas that are atrocious, and even average quality government schools produced mediocre education at high cost. For example, in my hometown, the Baltimore City Public Schools spent $15,000 per child in 2010 to 2011 academic year. Meanwhile, the median tuition charged by private schools attended by students receiving partial scholarships from the Children's Scholarship Fund Baltimore was $5,000 total. And these schools are considered so much better by the children's parents that they willingly pay out of pocket to send their children there. The numbers are not directly comparable because many of the CSF Baltimore schools include only grades K through 8, while the Baltimore City public schools include high schools, which are more expensive. Nevertheless, the numbers suggest that Baltimore could get better schooling for less than half of what's spent in government schools if only the quality of those schools were decently regulated. A properly regulated schooling industry would offer a wide range of approaches to K through 12 education, would quickly weed out bad schools and teachers, and over time would weed out mediocre schools and teachers. It would reward good schools and teachers. It would foster innovation in curricula, school organization, and the use of information technology. It would lower costs and increase choice. But we don't have a properly regulated system. Those who regulate the quality of our government schools do it badly. Why? Because those regulators are themselves unregulated. Officially, they are regulated from above by the political process, but the political process is so ineffective at regulating regulators that they are essentially unregulated. They are not accountable to the public in any meaningful way. Consider how government school quality is supposedly regulated. Suppose that somewhere in the country, the instruction of children in government schools is poor. Suppose further that money is not the problem, as in my hometown of Baltimore, where per pupil funding is nearly the highest in the state and far higher than the average tuition in private sector schools in the same area. Who is immediately responsible for regulating, that is, for improving and keeping at a high level the quality of instruction? The principals are. It's their job to make sure the teachers do a good job. But not all principals do a good job of making sure the teachers do a good job. They may allow poor instruction to continue because they lack the necessary authority for, or experience, or competence, or motivation, or support from their own superiors. Whatever the reasons may be, when principals don't do a good job, who is accountable? Who or what should regulate principals' performance? The school board should. It hires the principals. It is supposed to make sure the principals are getting good performance from teachers so that students can learn. But suppose the school board does a bad job, how is its performance to be regulated? A bad school board might not recognize the problem in its schools. It might be friendly with poor principals, or it might be doing the best it can, but be so tied down by the teachers' union contract that it can't require the changes it thinks are needed. Or despite the best will in the world, the board might simply not know what to do to improve a mediocre school district. Whatever the reason, in such cases, the unsatisfactory performance of the school board must not be tolerated. The school board itself must be regulated, held accountable, and required to do a better job. Who or what is to do that? In most states, school board members are democratically elected, so the citizens of the district, in their capacity as voters, are responsible for regulating school board quality. If a particular board is doing a poor job, then voters should vote its members out and vote in a good board, one that can recognize problems in its districts and schools, resist the temptation to hire or not fire personal friends, stand up to teachers' unions, and most essentially, know enough about teaching, learning, and school management to regulate well the schools it oversees. But voters as a whole are unlikely to be sufficiently well-informed and motivated to hold school boards to account at the ballot box. While some voters have children in their government schools, most do not. Also, voters realize that any one person's vote is unlikely to decide an election, and researching different candidates' qualifications and positions takes time. Hence, it does not make any sense for most voters to inform themselves of candidates' qualifications. They are rationally ignorant about the needs or problems of their local school system and the qualifications of the school board candidates. In some states, state departments of education take responsibility for regulating school boards. In extreme cases, a state government bureaucracy takes over underperforming schools or school districts and installs new management. But state departments of education may also perform well or badly for the same reasons school boards do. Who or what regulates the state departments of education? Well, the state legislatures do. And if a state legislature is doing a poor job of regulating the Department of Education, again, it falls to the citizens in their capacity as voters to vote out the legislators who are not regulating the Departments of Education and vote in new legislators who will. But here again, most voters know little to nothing about their representatives or candidates' positions on or competence in education policy. We can add to the mix the federal government's participation with President Bush's No Child Left Behind policy, President Obama's Race to the Top policy, and the push to implement Common Core, and most recently, the Every Student Succeeds Act signed by President Obama on December 15, 2015. The essential structure of government regulation of schooling remains the same. However, no matter how many layers of government overseers are added on, government schooling is regulated in a monolithic, top-down manner by a chain of political authority. Teachers are regulated by principals, who are regulated by school boards, who are regulated by state departments of education, who are regulated by state legislators, who are regulated by voters. Where in all this are the parents, the people with the most knowledge of their children's needs and the greatest incentive to see them educated well? Ultimately, parents do have some decision-making authority over the government schools their children attend. They vote. But what a dreadfully attenuated control that gives them. Only once every 2 years do they have any actual choice that affects this political structure. That choice is generally among candidates who may know or care little about education and whose positions on a host of other issues those parents must consider also. And each voter's vote has a vanishingly small chance of deciding the election. With government regulation of schooling, each higher level of regulatory responsibility is ever more distant from the students, classrooms, and teachers. At every remove, from principal to school board to Department of Education, the regulators have less and less knowledge of the students, the teachers, the school's culture, and teaching itself. At every remove, the incentives to act become more about politics and less about learning. What all this means in practice is that the regulators of government school quality are not regulated at all. The system does not force principals and school boards and legislatures to regulate well or to replace them if they don't. The same problem afflicts the regulation of all sorts of industries. Taxi and rideshare regulators in many cities actively harm the public interest by impeding ride-sharing services such as Uber and Lyft. They get away with this breach of duty because they are, in practice, unregulated by state legislatures. The FDA, in practice unregulated by Congress, misregulates new drug development so badly that it can take 10 years and over $1 billion for a new medicine to be developed and brought to market. Wrong-headed bank capital regulation encouraged banks to load up on mortgage-backed securities during the housing boom and so aggravated the financial crisis that followed. But Congress does not meaningfully regulate the regulators responsible: the Federal Reserve, the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency, and the FDIC. Occupational licensing boards routinely protect incumbent practitioners by blocking newcomers with excessively strict requirements, thereby harming the public with higher prices and fewer choices. These boards are in practice not regulated by their state legislatures. Ironically, regulation is so bad in our overregulated economy because our regulators are unregulated. There is a better way: regulation by market forces. Regulators need not be accountable upward to ever more distant layers of a political bureaucracy and thence to the public as voters who get to choose only every couple of years. In free markets, those who regulate are accountable downward to the public as customers who choose day to day or even moment to moment and thereby regulate the regulators very closely indeed. That article is by Howard Baecher Jr., and he is a lecturer in the Department of Economics at Towson University and a faculty member for seminars of the Institute for Humane Societies. That article was posted on the Foundation for Economic Education. It's called "Government Regulators Are Unregulated. There is a Better Way: Regulation by the Market." So, speaking a bit more about regulations that don't work, let's talk about the TSA. Joseph T. Salerno is going to talk about how the TSA kills hundreds of people every year. Experts increasingly agree that the TSA is inept and has not actually prevented any terrorist attacks on airplanes. Recently, Homeland Security sent a team to attempt to smuggle guns and bombs onto planes. The so-called Red Team succeeded on 67 out of 70 tries, or more than 95% of the time. Bruce Schneiner, a security expert, reportedly found, quote, basically zero evidence the agency has prevented any attacks. Even in the widely publicized by the TSA case of Kevin Brown, the TSA didn't prevent an airplane from being blown up because Brown was caught trying to check luggage containing materials for making a pipe bomb. But the TSA has never touted a case in which they caught someone actually trying to bring down a plane. Not only is there absence of evidence that the TSA saves lives, there is evidence that it may actually cause a significant number of deaths. In one paper, economists Garrick Bylock and Verinda Valley and Daniel Simon estimated that all other factors held constant, baggage screening procedures implemented after 9/11 reduced passenger volume by 6% overall and by 9% on planes departing from the nation's 50 busiest airports. Interestingly, the study also found that the introduction of federalized passenger screening did not significantly reduce passenger volume. The authors integrated these results with those of an earlier paper they had written on the direct effect of 9/11 on reducing airline travel and increasing driving and therefore deaths in auto accidents. The authors concluded that over a 3-month period, quote, approximately 129 individuals died in automobile accidents, which resulted from travelers substituting driving for flying in response to inconvenience associated with baggage screening. As one commentator starkly noted, this figure, when annualized, is the equivalent of 4 fully loaded Boeing 737s crashing each year. While one may quibble with the precise figures, a number of studies in the wake of 9/11 has confirmed the link between a reduction in airline passenger volume and an increase in driving and, inevitably, the number of fatalities from auto accidents. In sum, the benefits of the TSA are negligible, and the costs include, in addition to an annual budget of $7 billion, possibly hundreds of deaths per year. In light of these facts, considerations of economic efficiency and of basic human decency demand that the TSA be abolished, and that the important task of providing security for airline passengers be handed over to the competing airlines and airports, who are eager to find efficient, effective, and passenger-friendly market solutions to guarding their property, reputation, and the lives of their customers. That article was by Joseph T. Salerno. It's called How the TSA Kills Hundreds of People Every Year. So in the article, he mentioned Uber and Lyft and all of those ride-sharing, carpooling industries, and how the regulations are trying to shut those down in certain towns and cities as well. Austin just recently shut down Uber from moving into there, and wouldn't you know, people are just doing it anyway. They're just creating Facebook groups and coordinating their rides and things like that without having to use a legal organization such as Uber, but they're just doing it anyway. And so regulations don't really help. They are generally put in place to help the existing order of things. So the taxi companies don't want Uber, so they go to the government and they get these regulations passed. And then, wouldn't you know, Uber can't operate in that area anymore. Now, the last article I want to read is also talking about that. This is by Jared Mayer, and it's about how the FAA shot down Uber for planes. Imagine traveling from Boston to Martha's Vineyard in under an hour and for less than $70. Believe it or not, this option was available from FlightNow's website or app by looking for a general aviation pilot who was making that trip and then splitting the cost with that pilot and whoever else was sharing the flight. Entrepreneurs were bringing private air travel to the masses until FlightNow's leadership met with members of the Federal Aviation Administration to ensure that they were complying with all laws and regulations. Instead of embracing this service, the FAA used tortuous logic to ban FlightNow and other online flight-sharing websites because it considered these to be common carriers, such as Delta Airlines. Private pilots cannot possibly comply with the myriad regulations that apply to the large airlines. In what follows, FlightNow founders Alan Guckrid and Matt Voska explain why the federal government should make FAA allow flight sharing to get off the ground. Jared Meyer. Flight sharing is nothing new, as people have always tried to find ways to fill empty seats on private planes. The problem was finding someone who wanted to go where you wanted, at the time you needed. And from what I understand, it is still completely legal to find people to share flights and their costs by using old-fashioned tools such as bulletin boards or telephone calls. Why does the FAA not allow people to use peer-to-peer online interaction to make the process much more efficient and inclusive? Alan Guckrid. You're exactly right. Pilots have always been allowed to share flights as long as the pilot and the passenger share a common purpose, which they clearly have on an online bulletin board such as FlightNow. The FAA's concern is that online interaction will lead to sharing beyond what they refer to as friends and acquaintances. For example, the FAA explained that advertising a shared flight on Facebook would be permissible if a person only had a few friends, but that the same flight would transform the pilot into Delta or American Airlines if he or she had thousands of friends. The FAA's new requirement has the effect of restraining speech because there's no way for a pilot to know what communication is lawful versus what isn't. JM. Usually, the introduction of profits is what makes regulators go crazy. But what is especially troubling about the FAA's ban on your business model is that under existing law, pilots cannot profit from sharing their flights. They are only able to recoup the proportional cost of their trips. Can you continue explaining why the FAA harbors such a deep-seated hatred for flight sharing? Matt Voska. Understandably, they don't want an Uber of the skies to exist, but this is not what FlightNow is about. We're akin to carpooling for aviation. I think it's more of a knee-jerk reaction to new technology rather than a deep-seated hatred. Now, more than ever, innovation and regulation intersect due to more efficient communication methods, and regulators are almost always too slow to adapt. This has been true since the advent of the automobile, when regulators passed laws banning the running of horseless carriages. Unfortunately, the FAA has taken such a hardline approach when the exact same flight-sharing activity is now completely legal in the European Union. We joke that Europe has out-freedomed us, which is rare when it comes to internet technology. JM. Often pointless anti-competitive regulations are pushed by special interest groups that stand to benefit from maintaining the status quo. Other times, regulators myopically focus on regulating just for the sake of regulating, regardless of the negative effects that their new commandments have on consumers. What unites both of these approaches is the ever-present appeal to public safety. First, are there special interests behind the FAA's ruling? And second, why do appeals to public safety fail to hold water in this case? AG. We feel that special interests are at the heart of it. The FAA is being pressured by lobbyists in the private charter and airline arena to ban flight sharing. Why? Because flight sharing gives people options. Sharing a flight from Boston to Martha's Vineyard costs less than $70, whereas a charter would cost at least $1,000. These established business models see flight sharing as a threat. The FAA's appeal to public safety fails because banning the internet as a means of communication is not rationally related to safety. According to the FAA, it is perfectly okay for strangers who meet over a physical bulletin board to share a flight. But if those same people meet online, where flight sharing services such as FlightNow offer verified identities, then the flight magically transforms into an illegal commercial operation. Another one of my favorite examples is that now even Neil Armstrong or Captain Sully could share expenses with FlightNow because FAA's restrictions have nothing to do with pilot qualifications. JM. What is the best hope for convincing or forcing the FAA to modernize its approach to flight sharing? You would think patriotic pride alone would be enough, given that Europe is far ahead of the United States with its growing market for flight sharing. MV. We're working on multiple approaches right now. We're in the process of filing a petition for Cerutoni to appeal the U.S. Supreme Court in June. Additionally, we've received support in Congress on the issue. Representative Mark Sanford proposed an amendment to the FAA reauthorization bill that explicitly allows pilots to communicate and share their flights using the internet. It has passed through committee and is now awaiting a floor vote. We've had more pushback in the Senate, where charter lobbyists came out in opposition to putting the same language in the Senate version of the bill. Instead, Senator Cory Booker opted for a study on the topic to review making changes later. In Washington, a study means the legislation will likely never see the light of day. Ironically, the Senate recommended having the FAA itself conduct the study. We're urging people to make their views on this issue heard. It's more than just a pilot's right to communicate. The FAA's position sets a very dangerous precedent for other executive actions to prohibit what should be completely legal online activity. JM. This is a clear-cut case of an executive agency misusing its powers to stand in the way of innovation. The technology that enables more efficient flight sharing unquestionably helps consumers and pilots, and there is absolutely no reason for the FAA to stubbornly keep flight sharing grounded. This article was by Jared Mayer. It's called How the FAA Shot Down Uber for Planes. It was posted on the Foundation for Economic Education, but you can also read it on Forbes.com. So I hope that you enjoyed this. This has been another episode of the Austrian Circle. We talked about regulations and how regulations help the vested interests and the large monopoly companies who benefit from those regulations, but don't necessarily help the consumer. Have a great week. Take care.